democracy and human rights in Eritrea with this award. So, so in a way, I think the, what is being claimed here is that Abiy is supposed to solve Eritrea's problem, but that's, I think, a slightly different question.
Well, I want to thank you very much for being with us, Associate Professor at the Keele University of School of Law in Staffordshire, England. That does it for our broadcast. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks so much for joining us. This is Democracy Now!
This is KBOO Portland. The time is 5 o'clock. Coming up is the evening news after a few words.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the American Bamboo Society Annual Conference, Wednesday, October 16th through Sunday, October 20th at various locations around Portland. The American Bamboo Society Annual Conference features speakers and workshops, building with bamboo classes, and also tours of bamboo gardens, silent auctions, and more. Again, that's the American Bamboo Society Annual Conference, Wednesday, October 16th through Sunday, October 20th at various locations around Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the Soaring Spirits Gala on Saturday, October 19th from 6 to 9 p.m. at the All Saints Episcopal Church in Vancouver. The third Soaring Spirits Gala benefit concert features Heather Keller of Beauty of the Harp and the Celtic duo of Valerie K. Blessy and Jennifer Pratt Walter. The first half of the concert will focus on melodies of pre-Christian epic poetry and Jewish Kabbalah music. The second half features secular early traditional music and original music compositions by these artists. Again, that's the Soaring Spirits Gala on Saturday, October 19th from 6 to 9 p.m. at the All Saints Episcopal Church, 2206 Northwest 99th Street in Vancouver, Washington. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
KBOO programming is made possible by KBOO member listeners and support from Grundle's Coffee House, located at East Burnside Street and 8th Avenue in Portland, offering organic coffee, soup, sandwiches, and more for breakfast and lunch. Grundle's Coffee House is open daily until 5 p.m. More information on the Grundle's Facebook page and by phone at 503-595-9550.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, the hit-and-run death of an anti-fascist activist outside Cider Riot this weekend is being investigated as a homicide.
A demonstration against ICE was held outside City Hall today.
And a black woman was shot in Fort Worth by a police officer after leaving her front door ajar.
Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Monday, October 14th, 2019. I'm Ken Jones.
And I'm Michelle Coppola. An anti-fascist activist was killed early Saturday morning in a hit-and-run that police are investigating as a homicide. The victim, 23-year-old Sean Kelleher, was struck by an SUV a little after midnight outside Cider Riot in southeast Portland. Someone fired shots at the SUV after Kelleher was hit. The vehicle then crashed into the offices of the Democratic Party of Oregon, where it was later found abandoned by police who had been called to the scene. Rose City Antifa tweeted that Kelleher's death was, quote, not related to fascist activity. Kelleher, an experienced organizer in support of marginalized communities, has been described by those who knew him as, quote, a dedicated social justice community organizer, educator, and ally who was outspoken against racism, discrimination, and inequality. He was taken to the hospital by friends, where he later died. A memorial honoring Kelleher was set up on Saturday with flowers and candles marking the spot where he was hit. Police are asking anyone with information on the hit and run to contact them.
Back in February of 2018, KBOO's Greg McKelvey interviewed Sean Kelleher, also known as Armenio, on Voices from the Edge. Here's a clip of Kelleher talking about anti-fascism, Antifa, and the differences between them.
Today, we have a special guest. I'm here with Armenio, and he is a local anti-fascist, which I think we should all be anti-fascist, but could you introduce yourself?
Yeah, sure. Hi, I'm Armenio. I'm a Portland anti-fascist, and I've been doing this activity probably for the better part of 10 years now, since before Occupy Portland, and now we're here.
So what is the difference between anti-fascist and Antifa?
So that's actually a really easy question to answer. Antifa is the media side and the spectacle side of what we consider anti-fascist methodology. And to be an anti-fascist is simply to make an ideological disagreement with fascism. To be an Antifa is to get roped into the media blitz and the media stories and let them control the narrative about our politics.
Is there self-identified Antifa, or is it kind of like whoever is the bad guys or the media just picks and chooses who's Antifa?
I mean, you know, there's a mix of self-identified kids on the internet
who, yeah,
you know, get on Facebook because they don't have anywhere else to go.
Uh-huh.
But as far as real life declarations, Antifa is never something someone uses to describe themselves. It's always prescriptive from someone else.
So there's not like a card-carrying membership?
Oh, no, I wish there was. That'd be kind of cool.
There's no company barbecues?
No, nothing like that.
You get your George Soros checks or anything like that?
See, I wish, and that's always been my problem with anti-fascism, is we don't have money.
No.
And so, you know, people are always like, oh, you're this corporate thing, get all this money everywhere, and it's like, no.
And you're like, no, but that would be helpful. Do you have some?
Someone paid me for the hours of research I have to do.
So what is anti-fascist, like, organizing, or what does that mean in action?
So it all really depends on who you talk to. It can mean a plethora of different things, but more often than not, people kind of agree on the opinion that it is 99% boredom of detective work and 1% of fun, flashy fight scenes.
Uh-huh.
So
that's kind of like war.
Yeah, no, it really is like war. You have to know your enemy, and that what people really mistake anti-fascism for as, you know, these street fighting and stuff, mm-hmm, which there is a fair amount of it, especially in Europe, where you have to, where it's a life or death situation oftentimes, like Greece, for example. But here in America, you know, you have to know who the Nazis are, and part, yeah, of that is researching. And so, you know, when people think anti-fascist, they think, you know, oh, here's the big scary guys in the all black, when actually it's me in my underwear at 3 a.m. going through the white pages, court records, voting records, and trying to find addresses and different other stuff.
But is it also sometimes you in the scary costume?
No, I never do that.
But that is a part of anti-fascism.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Yeah,
and it's a necessary part?
Oh, 100%.
Why is that necessary?
So fascism, the way it finds its power is within its voice. And the more projection it has, the more power it can attain. The more people it reaches, the more people it can have. And so preventing it from reaching people prevents it from gaining more power. It's as simple as that.
And are the fascists, the bad guys, they're also not necessarily self-identified fascists, right?
Right, right. Like, you know, for instance, the Proud Boys.
Yeah.
They never declare themselves as fascists.
Uh-huh.
They declare themselves as Western chauvinists. But when you look at interviews with Gavin McManus and his economic positions, when you listen to what they believe, harsh traditionalism, celebration of colonialism and imperialism, what they embody is, you know, more traditional Mussolini-style fascism, uh-huh, which is capitalism and decay.
Yeah.
And so, you know, it's kind of the same thing. You know, no one on the left sometimes says they're an anti-fascist, and people on the right don't say they're fascist, but when you actually look at the nitty-gritty politics and the ideology involved, then that's really where it shows.
Last Friday, the Oregon Liquor Control Commission announced a 6-month ban on the sale of flavored vape products. This ban comes as a result of recent illnesses that have broken out. More than 1,000 people nationwide have been sickened by vaping. 2 Oregonians have died from vape-related illness. The ban will go into effect Tuesday, October 15th. All flavored tobacco and cannabis vaping products will be prohibited from online and retail stores in Oregon. The OLCC estimates over over 4,000 retailers will be impacted. Governor Kate Brown ordered the temporary ban earlier this month, with the OLCC voting in favor unanimously. Other states, including Washington, New York, and Michigan, have also imposed temporary bans. The illness first appeared in March. Many who were sickened used vaping products containing THC, while others said they vaped only nicotine-based products. Symptoms include shortness of breath, fatigue, and chest pain. Unflavored THC products, or those using marijuana-derived flavorings, including terpenes, are excluded from the ban.
This morning, the newly formed coalition Close the Camps, PDX, held a rally in downtown Portland for no deportations on stolen land. KBOO's Jezaniah Hawthorne has the story.
At 11 a.m. this morning on Indigenous People Day, a crowd gathered at Terry Shrunk Plaza in support of an ice-free Oregon. That is Sean Hudson, a First Nation community member, performing a land acknowledgement to begin the rally. After the land acknowledgement, Sean went on to open the rally.
The people coming together like this right now, stepping up and putting our foot down and putting our voice out in a positive, constructive manner, letting these people know that hold these positions within government offices, this is not okay. It's not okay to use our money, that we pay these taxes. We're the ones funding this. You know, and so for us to voice these opinions and these things to these people and let them know it is not okay for you to be doing this to these families.
Following Sean, Lilith Sinclair, chair of Close the Camps Coalition, explained that concentration camps are not just an immigrant justice issue, but also an Indigenous rights issue.
Indigenous people have been trying to tell us for years and years and years to live in a way that is sustainable, to recognize that we don't need capitalism, we don't need national border walls, we don't need all of these colonial ideas that keep us separated and keep us put into our divisions by class, by race, by gender, by sexuality, by all of these different means. It's pointless.
The next speaker was Angela Matika, a local youth activist with National Democratic of the Philippines.
I believe in the rights of all oppressed peoples to be free. I believe in the rights of children to be children, for them to play and learn and grow, and to be able to go to school without fear of coming home to empty houses, without fear of being ripped from their mother's side and packed into overcrowded and dirty cages indefinitely. I believe in the rights of children to not sleep on concrete floors, to not die from highly preventable diseases, cold and afraid and wondering why this is happening to them. We cannot stand quietly as this happens in front of us, and we must refuse to use watered-down or sugar-coated language when we are speaking about this. There are concentration camps currently operating in this country. People are suffering and dying in these camps. Children are suffering and dying in these camps from neglect and disease, and these deaths are nothing short of murder. And this systemic terror is nothing new. Colonized people have been tirelessly resisting imperialist violence since it has existed. And the fight for liberation from fascism will not stop until we are free from it and can build a world without war, without borders, without private prisons, and without for-profit child concentration camps.
With great passion, Alyssa Pariah, the co-chair of the Portland chapter of Jobs with Justice, finished out the rally.
I know it's hard to even get out of bed when you're watching the world go in terrible directions and you're watching people who you love and care about continue to be destroyed by the legacy of colonization and oppression inside of the crumbling empire, the so-called United States of America. For a second, I can get the pain and the groans from the bottom of your guts. And if you could scream out loud when I ask you to, and act like you're witnessing a genocide, if you could scream like all of the pain from the bottom of your feet to the top of your head could be heard by anyone who can hear you, if you could scream out for the people that have been killed and will continue to be killed because of these disgusting ideas that come out of sick people's heads in Europe that they call white supremacy and colonization, if you could scream with all of your pain right now, please do it.
I spoke with Evan Birchfield, a co-chair of external organizing in Portland, DSA.
What is the main goal that you're demanding at this protest?
So our main goal, our demand, is that we get all of the ICE contracts out of Oregon so that no private company, no public entity is contracting with ICE to provide them services. We've already had success with one of these contracts when we applied some pressure and contacted some officials to make them aware that Portland police were contracting with ICE to allow them to use their firing range, literally using their firing range so that they could train to shoot and kill immigrants. So we, when we rose that up the ladder, we got the right people involved, and then they were able to apply public pressure, and then Portland police canceled that contract 2 weeks ago.
What is your organization's short-term and long-term goals?
So short-term right now, I think, is to build a coalition. We want to have more organizations that are doing work in immigrant justice, indigenous justice, organizations led by people of color. We want to be able to build this into a sturdy coalition that is centering marginalized voices. So short-term, it's really building up the coalition now that we've had both a success as well as we've practiced with a few actions. Long-term is that we really want to get the ICE contracts out of Oregon. So that demand for this rally is more of a setting of the stage for the next year of activism. We want to make sure that Oregon, no company in Oregon, can contract with ICE without having to come under public pressure.
And you already answered my next question, the progress that we've made. Is there any other progress that you guys made other than the one you already listed?
So right now, that is the contract that we were able to get canceled between Portland Police and ICE is the biggest win that we've had so far. But what's happening right now is this has refocused our efforts. Right now, the Portland Police still contract with Department of Homeland Security to also use that firing range for a very similar purpose. It's just that ICE deals with the deportation of all of what they consider illegal immigrants. And with DHS, they will handle just what's considered criminal activity, and so the people who are the gravest threat, violent threat. And that's more of the standard that Obama applied for deporting immigrants. So DHS is still a part of the problem. DHS is still a group that is part of a deporting, breaking up families and putting people into concentration camps, just as much as CBP, which is Border Patrol, and ICE, Immigration and Customs Enforcement. Beyond that, we also have an interest in applying pressure to the city, because the city right now is allowing for a private company to lease their building to ICE for their facility on McAdam. And that facility, that lease had to be approved by the city, and the city went ahead and approved it about 2 years ago, maybe 3 years ago, and right now we want to put pressure on them to say, you need to deny this now. And the city has routinely thrown their hands in the air and said, well, what can we do now? And we're like, exercise your power. Like, that's what you have to do. So we're going to keep pushing on that one too.
What can our listeners do to get involved?
The best thing that you can do to get involved is if you are a part of an organization, you can join this coalition. If you're part of an organization that's fighting for immigrant justice, fighting for climate justice, fighting for indigenous justice, then you can join this coalition. And that would be a great way to create strength. We're stronger together, and we're going to be able to actually fight back better if we have more voices in the room rather than just a few. Also, I would say that if you're not a member of one of those organizations, now's the time to join. Get involved. Find the fight that you want to fight, and don't just sit back. It's not enough to be angry. It's not enough to be upset, because it hits me. It makes me upset. I'm not even the victim of these things, and it makes me upset. But I could just as easily sit at home and do nothing. It's time to stop doing nothing. It's time to start doing something.
Awesome. Thank you.
For the KBOO Evening News, I'm Jesniah Hawthorne.
Oregon may soon allow customers to bring their own reusable food containers into grocery stores and restaurants. That's in an effort to reduce single-use plastic waste. State officials say the push for reusable options comes following China's decision in 2018 to stop allowing many items from the U.S. to be imported for recycling. Since then, Oregon citizens have thrown away more than 16,000 tons of previously recyclable items, most of them single-use plastics like carry-out containers. Calls for a rule change intensified after the state cracked down on a program at First Alternative Co-op in Corvallis. They'd been washing and reusing containers for years. The current proposal will allow facilities to opt in to allow consumer-provided containers for certain foods. Earlier this year, California Governor Gavin Newsom signed a bill allowing clean, consumer-owned containers to be filled at restaurants and stores across that state. Washington is also working to revise its laws.
Burgerville workers gathered outside the Montevilla Burgerville location last Friday to protest a stalemate in their contract negotiations with the corporation. The union said that if no deal can be reached by Friday, they intend to strike. KBOO's S.J. Oxendine was on the scene Friday with Burgerville union organizer Esther Mann.
What brings you here today?
Well, we've been in contract negotiations with Burgerville for over a year now. I think almost 2 years. And we've been working on issues like wages and breaks, and they have been stalling on giving us wage proposals and any proposals that we can really work with in bargaining. And we've given them an ultimatum as of a week or so ago, saying that as of the 18th of October, if they don't sign a fair contract with the Burgerville Workers Union, we're going to escalate the way that we see fit and show them the power of our union.
Why don't you go into it a little bit, the demands that you'd like for
them
to meet?
Yeah, so we're fighting for a raise because a lot of our workers are living in poverty, and there's this kind of stigma around fast food workers that it's an easy job and that we don't deserve more than minimum wage. But you know, I come home every day with my back hurting and my feet hurting, and it's a really hard job, even though it doesn't seem like it. And we are fighting for the contract because we believe that we deserve better, and it doesn't have to be a quote-unquote bad job. Like, it doesn't have to be... People think that fast food workers don't deserve anything, but that's just because that's what the precedent has been set, and we're showing that we do deserve more, and we do deserve a raise and 15-minute breaks and paid holiday leave and tips, which we just won tips and holiday pay, which is really lovely. Yeah.
What do you want to see come from this going forward? How would you like to see a resolution to all of this?
I want them to buckle down and give us a contract and sign a contract with us before the 18th, because we should not have been waiting 2 years for a fair contract, because our workers are poor and we need the money and we need to be living in or working in a job that gives us a livable wage and gives us a steady income and fair scheduling, and we're not right now. So I want to see some transparency from the company in why they haven't given us anything to work with, and I want to see them be in more than just talk right now.
All right, once and finally, how can Portlanders or Oregonians in general show their support for what you're doing?
You can, first of all, follow the Burgerville Workers Union Facebook page. We put a lot of updates out there on how you can support us. You can come to our actions next Saturday at 11 a.m. There's a rally where Burgerville workers will be speaking on the outcome of our contract, whether or not they've decided to give us a fair contract or let us escalate the way that we know how. And that'll be on the Hawthorne Bird, the waterfront. You can also boycott Burgerville until they sign a fair contract with their workers. There's been a boycott out for a while now, and you can sign a boycott pledge online and donate money to the union.
That was KBOO's S.J. Oxendine speaking with Burgerville union organizer Esther Mann last Friday at the union's picketing of the Montevilla Burgerville. This Friday, October 18th, is the deadline for the union. If no deal is reached by then, the workers plan to strike.
On this Indigenous Peoples Day, two Pacific Northwest tribes are calling for the removal of three major dams along the Columbia River. It's in an attempt to restore traditional fishing sites that were guaranteed to the tribes in a treaty more than 150 years ago. The Yakima and Lummi Nations' demand refers to a treaty from 1855 in which 14 tribes ceded over 11 million acres to the United States. The Bonneville, John Day, and the Dalles Dams have destroyed important native fishing sites and deeply impacted the migration of salmon along the river. The dams are also responsible for the dwindling number of orca in our region, whose primary food source is salmon. Lummi Nation Chairperson Jeremiah Julius said on Monday, quote, "Our people understand that the salmon, like the orca, are the miner's canary for the health of the Salish Sea and for all its children." Environmental groups have applauded the tribe's demand, calling current attempts to save salmon in the Columbia River impractical because the stagnant reservoirs behind the dams create dangerously warm water, causing the river's ecosystem to go out of balance.
Open enrollment for Medicare begins tomorrow and lasts through December 7th. Beneficiaries are encouraged to compare their current plans with other plans on the market. Here's more on the story.
Starting tomorrow, Medicare enrollees and folks new to the program can review their plans or sign up for 2020. Open enrollment in the health insurance program runs from October 15th to December 7th, giving nearly 860,000 Oregonians the opportunity to switch up their coverage if they choose. Lisa Emerson is with the Senior Health Insurance Benefits Assistance, or SHIBA, program, which helps Oregonians navigate Medicare enrollment. She says there are more than two dozen plans to sift through.
So it's very important to compare them and do that on an annual basis, which you could save considerable money. And also just making sure that you have the coverage of benefits that you need in the new year, making sure that certain prescriptions are covered on the individual prescription drug list.
AARP Oregon encourages folks to look at their options during open enrollment to make sure they have the right plan heading into next year. Changes go into effect at the beginning of 2020. The SHIBA program receives a federal grant to assist Medicare beneficiaries and consists of a statewide network of counselors who can walk people through the process. The agency works with local partners to provide in-person assistance as well. Emerson encourages folks to reach out.
SHIBA can be a great advocate and provide counseling and information and assistance.
Oregonians can find assistance online at sheba.oregon.gov or by calling 1-800-722-4134. And Emerson says the assistance program is always looking for volunteers. For KBOO Evening News and the Oregon News Service, I'm Nat Moon.
The state of Michigan has retracted $600 million in funding from Camas-based Fisher Investments after the CEO's heinous sexual comments sparked outrage at a summit last week. Fisher Investments founder and chairman Ken Fisher made sexually explicit, misogynistic, and racially insensitive comments at the Tiburon CEO Summit in San Francisco. That was during a speech where he compared his wealth management strategy to soliciting women for sex. Attendees also reported that Fisher spoke of doing acid, made crude comments about genitalia, and that he views charities as, quote, immoral. Michigan Chief Investment Officer John Breudigam informed the state's investment board that its Bureau of Investments, housed under Michigan's Treasury Department, had terminated its relationship with Fisher Investments due to those comments. Tiburon policy has previously maintained confidentiality among summit attendees. Three CEOs publicly came forward and shared their accounts via social media, online confirmations, and media reports. They did so in hopes of holding the self-made multi-billionaire accountable. Fisher was initially defiant at the backlash. He has since issued a formal apology for his comments.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for an in-depth report on a new book by Loreen Nussbaum, which details how a German bureaucrat saved over 3,700 Jews in Amsterdam from the Holocaust. At 6, we'll hear Labor Radio. At 6:30, it's Prison Pipeline. Then at 7, it's Hard Knock Radio, news and views from a hip-hop perspective. Tonight's weather will be partly cloudy with a low of 43 degrees. Tomorrow's weather, cloudy with a high of 65 degrees. Today in history, in 1964, Martin Luther King Jr. received the Nobel Peace Prize for combating racial inequality through nonviolence. The quote of the day is from Martin Luther King, who said, quote, "We must develop and maintain the capacity to forgive. He who is devoid of the power to forgive is devoid of the power to love. There is some good in the worst of us and some evil in the best of us. When we discover this, we're less prone to hate our enemies."
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. I'm Michelle Coppola, and we do have some breaking news for you. The former Fort Worth police officer who shot and killed a woman in her home Saturday morning has been charged with murder tonight. Tatiana Jefferson, 28, was playing video games in her bedroom with her 8-year-old nephew at the time of the shooting. Fort Worth police responded to a non-emergency call placed by a neighbor of Jefferson's around 2 a.m. Saturday morning. The neighbor noticed the front door to the Jefferson residence had been adjourned for some time. Two Fort Worth officers arrived at the scene. After creeping over a fence and surveying the perimeter, body camera footage shows one officer peering into a window shouting, "Put your hands up, show me your hands." A shot was fired. At no time did either officer state they were the police. Upon entering the residence, the officers, who are white, located Jefferson, who was black, and pronounced her dead at the scene. The officer has been with the department since April of 2018 and resigned earlier today after being placed on administrative leave. The officer is now going to face charges in that killing. Jefferson's tragic death follows an earlier Texas murder involving a white police officer shooting an unarmed black man in his apartment. Off-duty Dallas police officer Amber Geiger said she mistakenly entered Botham Jean's apartment, believing it to be her own, and shot John, thinking he was a burglar.
Farm workers and advocates in California are celebrating the state's end to the sale of chlorpyrifos, a toxic pesticide. Suzanne Potter has more.
Farm workers groups are celebrating the end of at least a decade-long battle to ban a toxic pesticide in California after the state EPA announced a new deal with manufacturers of chlorpyrifos. The pesticide will no longer be sold to growers in California after February 6, 2020. Naimin Martinez, director of the Central California Environmental Justice Network, says studies have linked chlorpyrifos to serious health effects in kids.
It's a very dangerous chemical that can cause harm, especially in brain development, for unborn children and young children who live in close proximity where this pesticide is applied.
Chlorpyrifos is widely used to control pests on a variety of crops, including alfalfa, almonds, citrus, cotton, grapes, and walnuts. Farmers can still spray their existing stocks through the end of next year as long as they respect buffer zones. The state has dedicated $5 million for grant money to search for an environmentally friendly alternative. In 2016, under President Barack Obama, the U.S. EPA had decided to ban chlorpyrifos nationwide. But President Donald Trump's first EPA director, Scott Pruitt, reversed the decision against the advice of the agency's scientists. Martinez notes that Dow Chemical, a chlorpyrifos manufacturer, donated $1 million to the Trump inauguration.
Dow was one of the main contributors to Trump's administration funds. So it's not surprising that at the federal level, this didn't happen, more for a political reason than anything else.
Martinez says rural Fresno, Kern, and Tulare counties are the top users of chlorpyrifos in the state, with especially high usage near the Central Valley towns of Lindsay, Orange Cove, and Tranquility. For Public News Service, I'm Suzanne Potter.
Building solar and wind farms can be very expensive, and in order to get funding, developers have to prove they can make that money back. Anthony Lisowitz has more on the story with Climate Connections.
I'm Dr. Anthony Lisowitz, and this is Climate Connections. Getting a lot more renewable energy on the grid requires building large solar and wind farms. They can cost hundreds of millions of dollars each. To secure financing for these projects, developers have to prove that they will make that money back over time.
Otherwise, no lender is going to give you a loan to build a project.
Craig Gordon is with Invenergy, a wind and solar developer. He says one way to provide that guarantee is through a power purchase agreement.
A power purchase agreement is simply a contract between a wind farm or a solar farm and a buyer, like a utility or a large industrial customer like Google or Facebook or Microsoft, which enables us to go to the bank and say, look here, bank, we have a 20-year contract with XYZ utility for X amount of dollars. Now will you lend us the money so that we can build this project?
He says entering into these contracts is also valuable for the companies or utilities buying the energy. It locks in a long-term price and shows they have a plan to meet clean energy targets. So a power purchase agreement is a lot more than a legal document. It's a tool to help transition to a clean energy economy. Climate Connections is produced by the Yale Center for Environmental Communication. Learn more at yaleclimateconnections.org.
Spain's Supreme Court sentenced 9 Catalan separatist leaders on Monday to prison terms varying from 9 to 13 years on charges of sedition, misuse of public funds, and disobedience. The sentencing came 2 years after a failed referendum on Catalan independence that was initially deemed legal by the government of Spain and largely backed by Catalan voters. Low voter turnout and a lack of observers cast doubt on the legitimacy of the results, prompting an inquiry and the subsequent trial of the separatist leaders. The Supreme Court's ruling rejected the argument that Spain violated civil rights laws by not honoring the results of the 2017 referendum. The ruling today immediately triggered demonstrations across Spain, rejecting the sentences, with protesters calling for the government to negotiate a different solution. Thousands of protesters marched at major transit hubs, with many gathering at the Barcelona airport in a movement designed to bring transport to a standstill.
In Arizona, a proposal to dam the Little Colorado River is being opposed by conservation groups who say it could create an ecological disaster. Mark Richardson has more on that story.
Conservation groups say a proposal to build dams along Arizona's Little Colorado River could trigger an environmental disaster. A Phoenix-based company has filed for a permit to construct 2 dams that would generate power through a process known as pumped hydro storage. It would also create a pair of reservoirs stretching 2 miles up the Little Colorado River Gorge. Allison Gitlin with the Sierra Club's Grand Canyon chapter says the project could threaten an endangered species, interfere with the Grand Canyon's already degraded hydrology, and damage sites held sacred by 2 Arizona tribes.
This happens to be in a place that has critical cultural significance to the Hopi and Navajo nations. It is ecologically a terrible idea because it is going to remove about 80 to 90% of endangered humpback chub spawning habitat.
The company seeking the permit, Pumped Hydro Storage, says the project would generate electricity by pumping water between the 2 dams. Hopi and Navajo tribe officials have not yet commented on the project. The Federal Energy Regulatory Commission has granted an initial permit to begin planning the project. The project would create an upper dam 240 feet tall and about 3,000 feet above the lower dam, which would be 140 feet tall. Turbines would be used to pump water to the generators. Gitlin says the project would completely change the river's character.
On top of all the effects that you would have on the river, you would also be losing all of that habitat. Over 4.5 miles of riverine habitat would be gone. And then you would have effects downstream, such as changing temperature, changing sediment loads, changing flood peaks.
She says the result would likely wipe out the habitat of at least 1 endangered species that local groups have worked hard to save.
The humpback chub is dependent upon the Little Colorado River as its main spawning habitat, and if we lost that population, it's very possible that that fish would be dependent upon artificial spawning in other locations to keep it going.
Pumped Hydro Storage does not yet own the water rights or land use permits needed to proceed with construction. FERC is taking public comment on the permit through November 22nd. For Public News Service, I'm Mark Richardson.
You've heard of bike trails, and most agree they're important for increasing accessibility for cyclists, but have you considered paddling trails? With more on the story, it's CurrentCast.
Blazing trails, water trails in Michigan on this CurrentCast. Kayaking and canoeing on lakes and rivers is nothing new, but there's a growing movement to promote and improve access to paddling routes.
Today, there's an official water trail on just about every mile of Great Lakes coastline that touches Michigan.
Harry Burkholder directs the Land Information Access Association in Traverse City. He says designated water trails have signs to guide paddlers and can be easily accessed from sites that often have parking, bathrooms, and drinking water. He says water trails make it easy for new people to give paddling a try. And as more people enjoy spending time on the water, there will be more people invested in protecting it. Current Cast is produced in partnership with Cornell University's Atkinson Center for a Sustainable Future. Learn more online at currentcast.org.
Speaking of big water news, Typhoon Hagibis slammed into Japan over the weekend, causing devastating flooding in regions around Tokyo. Nearly 40 inches of rain fell in some places, causing rivers to overflow, breaking levees, and sending muddy water surging through neighborhoods. As water recedes from residential areas, the death toll is expected to climb. The storm has claimed the lives of 58. That's according to Japanese public broadcaster NHK. The Japanese government ordered the evacuation of 8 million residents as the typhoon landed. Haneda Airport recorded hurricane force winds and gusts of 98 miles per hour. Over 1,000 homes have been wiped out and hundreds of thousands are without power. Typhoon Hagibis caused great damage, largely due to its inner core remaining intact as it ravaged Tokyo. By only coming ashore for a relatively brief time, the storm was able to tap into energy from the ocean and weaken at a much slower rate than most storms hitting Japan. After making landfall Saturday evening, the core of the storm pulled away from Tokyo on Sunday. Heavy rains dumped across Toshigi and Fukushima Prefecture, raising concerns about radioactive water contamination following the 2011 Fukushima nuclear disaster. Estimates of damage from Typhoon Hagibis are already in the billions of dollars. That is according to local officials.
For at least five states and numerous cities, today marks the first time they'll celebrate Indigenous Peoples Day instead of Columbus Day. With that story and more, it's Megan Kamrick with National Native News, the daily newscast dedicated to Indigenous news, issues, and culture.
This is National Native News. I'm Megan Kamrick in for Antonia Gonzalez. An increasing number of localities have changed Columbus Day to Indigenous Peoples Day, including the District of Columbia, where the mayor signed a bill changing the holiday on Friday, just in time for the actual holiday on Monday. The New York Times reports at least five states have renamed the Columbus Day holiday over the past year, as have many cities and towns. Among the places celebrating Indigenous Peoples Day for the first time are Maine and Vermont, which so far are the only New England states to make the switch. Although the mayor of Waterville, Maine, proclaimed October 14th would still be Columbus Day in his town, he said people were tired of, quote, selective historical outrage. New Mexico will observe its first Indigenous Peoples Day with dances and speakers at the Indian Pueblo Cultural Center in Albuquerque and with events on Santa Fe's Plaza. Wisconsin Governor Tony Evers signed an executive order last week declaring the 14th as Indigenous Peoples Day after 3 years of advocacy by students at the Indian Community School in Franklin, Wisconsin. In Dallas, the city council passed a resolution recognizing Indigenous Peoples Day, but it took out a line that stated honoring Columbus Day promoted intolerance. Grand Forks, North Dakota will also celebrate the day for the first time. And in Alexandria, Virginia, an additional resolution calls for sports organizations in the state to stop using Indigenous peoples' likenesses as mascots. A group of Native American tribes is arguing the opioid crisis has had a disproportionate impact on Native communities. The group wants its own representative in the massive bankruptcy case of OxyContin manufacturer Purdue Pharma. Bloomberg reports the group asked Judge Robert Drain to appoint a committee to represent its interests. There's a creditor committee in place, but the group argued in a court filing that there are no Native Americans on that committee and it doesn't represent tribal interests. Attorney Sander Esserman argued in a motion for the Native American group that abating the opioid crisis in Indian country requires giving tribes the power to control and direct resources. The creditor committee has said it will represent all unsecured creditors, even if they're not on the committee. Esserman wrote that the equivalent of 97 million opioid pills were distributed in Oklahoma counties in 2015 that are part of the Cherokee Nation. The filing cited statistics from the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention that Native American overdose deaths increased by more than 500% from 1995 to 2015, the biggest increase among racial and ethnic groups. Officials with the Atlanta Braves baseball team will reach out to Native Americans about the controversial tomahawk chop tradition that has been part of its games for nearly three decades. The Atlanta Journal-Constitution reports team officials did not give details on which groups it will speak with, but leaders for the Cherokee and Creek Nations have publicly supported St. Louis Cardinals relief pitcher Ryan Helsley's comments that he found the chanting and arm motions by fans insulting. Helsley is a member of the Cherokee Nation. He made the statements in an interview with the St. Louis Post-Dispatch before Game 2 of the National League Divisional Series against the Braves. In response, the Braves stopped handing out foam tomahawks and using the music and the chop graphic when the series returned to Atlanta. Principal Chief James R. Floyd of the Muscogee Creek Nation said the tomahawk chop is not an appropriate acknowledgement of tribal tradition or culture. He said it reduces Native Americans to caricatures and minimizes their contributions as citizens and human beings. After the Braves were defeated 13-1 in Game 5, several Republican leaders in Georgia blamed the removal of the chop tradition, with one calling it karma. Braves officials said in a statement, "We look forward to a continued dialogue with those in the Native American community after the postseason concludes." For National Native News, I'm Megan Kamrick in for Antonio Gonzalez.
The world's first hydrogen-powered boat has docked in London. That's completing its 18,000 nautical mile journey. The 30-meter Energy Observer visited 25 countries propelled solely by renewable energies, solar, wind, and hydro, since its departure from Saint-Malo, France, in 2017. Energy Observer has been acting as a floating lab for testing green maritime technology. The boat does not emit CO2, fine particles, or make noise. Solar panels cover 168 square meters of Energy Observer, and its 12-meter ocean wings harness wind power. Wave power generates electricity via propellers. Most notably, however, Energy Observer is claiming to be the first vessel in the world that can produce its own hydrogen on board through seawater electrolysis. At a cost of nearly $7 million, Energy Observer's technology isn't affordable to a majority of the maritime industry. Captain Vittorian Irusard claims this will change as further technological advances will soon reduce the price. Among other sites visited during its maiden voyage, Energy Observer's crew were able to witness firsthand the impact of climate change. Sailing to the island of Spitsbergen in Norway's Svalbard archipelago, melting glaciers could be seen. That is vastly different from photographs taken 100 years ago.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News for Monday, October 14, 2019. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. You can call us with your breaking news stories and tips at 503-231-8032. Our production team for tonight's newscast is Jezaniah Hawthorne, S.J. Oxendine, Nat Moon, and Jeffrey Wade. The producer is Althea Billings, and our engineer is Jeff Henderson. The director of Evening News at KBOO is Althea Billings. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You're listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Ken Jones.
And I'm Michelle Coppola. Stay tuned for News in Depth, where KBOO's Althea Billings will be speaking with author Laureen Nussbaum about her new book, Shedding Our Stars, the story of Hans Kallmayr and how he saved thousands of families like mine. Have a good night.
KBOO News in Depth, where we take a deeper look at the top news stories impacting our community.
We are here today with Laureen Nussbaum, who has a new book, Shedding Our Stars, the story of Hans Kallmayr, and how he saved thousands of families like mine. Welcome, Laureen.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Yeah. So let's talk about your book. Can you tell me a little bit about it?
Well, the book came about because Hans Kallmayr was a very important person in my life. In fact, if it weren't for him, I wouldn't be here. He saved my life. So when a German biography about him appeared, I felt that we needed to have something in English about him. So I started translating a German biography and found that the text was too much geared to the German public, so it would not fly in this country. And then I started rewriting and wrote my own book. And some friends, Ursula Le Guin among them, prevailed upon me that I should mix my own story into the book, so it would be not only about Hans Kallmayr, but also about my own family and how we survived. And that's what the book is about.
Can you tell me a little bit about that story in particular, your story, your relation to Hans Kallmayr?
Well, my story is that I was born in Frankfurt, Germany, the same city that Anne Frank was born. In fact, my parents and the Franks knew each other in Frankfurt. And the Franks before us in 1933 and we in 1936 left Frankfurt because of Hitler and the prevailing Nazi ideology, Nazi laws, and so on. So we found ourselves as refugee families in the Netherlands. And I grew up essentially in Amsterdam. My feelings, Amsterdam is my home city rather than Frankfurt.
So who was Hans Kallmayr?
Hans Kallmayr was a German lawyer who was an anti-Nazi. He never joined the Nazi party. In fact, he thought himself of leaving Germany because he was so disgusted with the Nazis. But then relatives advised him not to. He found himself a soldier in 1940, and he was in the Netherlands right after the Germans occupied the Netherlands. He did not like at all to play the military games. He was very much against the military. So as soon as he could, he went to The Hague, where the occupation government was using the premises of the Dutch government. The Dutch queen and her ministers, secretaries had left, and so they had their offices in The Hague, and Kallmayr went there. He knew of a important person in his own city, in Osnabrück, who had a function there, and he asked this man, Carlo Studer, would you by any chance have a job for me? I want to get out of the military. And this man said, yes, right now we really need somebody who is a good lawyer, because of the new decree that all Jews have to register. And there are doubtful cases, and we need a lawyer to decide doubtful cases. So that's how Kallmayr got his job in the Netherlands. He was the one person who was to decide whether a petitioner who claimed that he was not as Jewish as his or her papers read, he had to decide whether the claim was justified or not. And okay. He used this position to help as many Jews as he could.
Okay, and how exactly did he do that?
Well, how he did it was because he, the laws were written in a funny way. You know, the Germans were so sure that this has to be a racial thing. But how do you define a Jew? Well, they defined a Jew as somebody who had three or more Jewish grandparents. How do you decide what are Jewish grandparents? Well, they had to be, or have been, or be to be members of the Jewish congregation. Forgetting that there were many non-Jewish wives who, when they got married to a Jewish husband, joined the congregation just for the sake of peace in the family.
Right.
And that, so that's how he found a little loophole, and he used his position to help people find these loopholes, essentially.
Okay. And so what helped your family to survive?
My family had the fact that I did have an absolutely honest-to-goodness non-Jewish grandmother, and all we had to do now is affix a non-Jewish grandfather to her, which was the trick, and then my mother would be not Jewish at all, and then it would be a mixed marriage, and my family would survive. So fortunately, my mother's Jewish grandmother was a bigot. Yay for bigotry. She did not want and insisted that her Jewish son was not going to get married to a non-Jewish woman. And her son was a good son. He did what his mom said. So he never married my grandmother till his mother died. By that time, my mother was 20. So my mother has grown up as a out of wedlock illegitimate child, and that was our saving, because Karlmeyer said, well, the mother was clearly not Jewish. Who am I to say that the father was Jewish? The fact that this Jewish man married her 20 years later does not prove that that's the father. Close the case.
Wow. Okay. Mm-hmm. So you mentioned Anne Frank earlier. I'm wondering, what do you think is something that we overlook today when we talk about Anne Frank?
Well, you have to be careful, because I'm a retired literature professor, and for me, Anne Frank is particularly important as a writer. This has been my hobby horse for 25 years. I have always been unhappy that Mr. Frank, however dear he was, and he really was a dear man, took it upon himself to mix Anne's original jottings down with her rewrite. That's the book that all of you have read, is a combination of two different versions. And I always pleaded for the rewritten version, because that's what we do with any writer. We take the last version. And Mr. Frank didn't do that. So finally, now this last May, a German edition came out with the unadulterated version that Anne wanted to publish. And I wish we could read it in English too, and in Dutch, the original, but we can't because of copyrights. So that's...
Oh, interesting. Okay. I've been told that Otto Frank was best man at your wedding. Can you tell me how that happened?
He was indeed. When he came back all by himself... I always liked him. He was an ideal daddy, so I made sure I always bought flowers for his birthday and for family birthdays and so on. And so we kept close contact. And when my husband and I got married in 1947, just a few months after the diary came out for the first time, he was our best man at a wedding. Yes, indeed. And we kept in touch till he died, essentially. He died in 1980 at age of 91.
Lorraine, can you tell me about your work with the Anne Frank Project?
Well, it all started really in 1992 when the Anne Frank exhibit, the first Anne Frank exhibit, came to the church. I forget what? Methodist Church, that's right, at the Methodist Church. A questionnaire went out to people who might have firsthand experience with surviving the Holocaust. Would there be ready and available to speak to the general public? And my husband and I both were ready to do that. So from that time on, really, I found myself more and more involved in answering requests to speak to people about the experience of being a refugee and a survivor. Yes.
So you were someone who was a refugee during and after World War II. Do you see any parallels to what's going on in the world today when we're talking about refugees?
Heavens, yes. I mean, if I think of the people at the southern border of the United States, I get gooseflesh, really. It's awful what we are doing to people who want to have a safe life and a future for their children. Of course there are parallels, very much so, yes.
Tell me about that. Tell me about living without a country.
We were stateless. Hitler made all of us stateless. I think it was in 1941. I'm not entirely sure right now. All of us lost our German nationality. So at the end of the war, we had no passports. We were stateless. And for instance, my then fiancé, later husband, wanted to work for the Red Cross, but the Red Cross didn't take any stateless people. He wanted to actually, you know, go to the concentration camps and help the people. He was young and strong, but he was not wanted because he had no passport. And when our first child was about to be born, we still were stateless. So my father had this great idea, why don't you go to England? At least one member of the family will have a nationality. So I went to London and I stayed with the family of Ted Koppel. That's why Ted Koppel writes the introduction to my book, because I've known him since he was 8 years old. So we stayed in the house of the, I stayed in the house of the Koppels, gave birth to our oldest son, who then flew back with me to Amsterdam, the proud owner of a British passport at the age of 13 days.
Wow. And why do you think that's so important?
I think that's important because people need to know about this. When you read in books, you don't really get the direct personal experience that a person can convey who has been in it. And also, of course, that I mentioned that in the book, the injustice that is sort of built in society when my husband and his parents tried to leave Europe to come to the United States in the late 30s when their life depended on it. And both his parents were Holocaust victims. Of course, they were not wanted, just like we don't want people now at the southern border. When in 1957, he was a nuclear physicist and he applied, yay, come in, because the Russians have Sputnik and we want physicists, you know, the same person, which is an irony and an injustice in my book.
Right, the qualifications at various times. Yeah. What do you want listeners to remember the most from your story?
Well, what I find most important is that right now in a period when people scratch their head and say, well, it's awful what the United States is doing. They don't agree with the president. What can we do as individuals? And Hans Kallmayr shows that if you look carefully, there often are little things you can do that can at least save lives. If they can't maybe save history, but they can save lives. And that's, I think, very important.
Right. Hans Kallmayr saved, what was it, 3,700 Jews?
At least, yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow. Well, Lorene, I hear you have some book events coming up. Can you tell me about those?
Yes, I have. I have two in Portland. One is at the First Unitarian Church on Main Street. I think it's 1200 block, and that's at 7 in. And that's another book launch. I have also something at Portland State on Monday. Maybe I wasn't clear. Tuesday, the 15th at 7 at the Unitarian Church, and then at Portland State at 3:30 in the Browsing Library, that's room 238, Smith Center. There's a talk where I speak about resistance as a viable option and take Hans Kallmayr as an example.
Very cool. Is there anything else you want to...
No, I think I'm very grateful that you want to listen to me.
Yeah, thank you so much for coming in. We've been speaking with Lorene Nussbaum, the author of the new book, Shedding Our Stars, the story of Hans Kallmayr and how he saved thousands of families like mine.
You're listening to KBOO, Portland, Oregon. Up next, Labor Radio.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with the requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is available by calling the station at 503-231-8032. Meetings will be held at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue, unless otherwise noted. The Finance Committee meets on the third Thursday at 4:30 p.m.
To you, the 9-to-5-er, just making your way.